Joining me today is a three-peat guest, I think three times on ANC and plus one interview we did on Boiling Frogs Post, is the director of ERMEP, Grant F. Smith. And ERMEP was also one of the sponsors, annual sponsors, for the conferences in Washington dealing with the Israeli lobby. We say the lobby, it's really more of a set of lobbies, but that's what we're going to get into today is Grant's new book called Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America. And there's a quote on the front from Bibi, Benjamin Netanyahu, from 2001, where he said, America is a thing you can move very easily. Of course, he wasn't aware that he was being recorded, I think, when he said that. But we will get all into the lobby and the Israeli affinity groups. Everybody knows about AIPAC. And then there's the Friends of Fill-in-the-Blank Org and Jewish Community of Fill-in-the-Blank Org, plus your so-called scientific Israeli affinity organizations and a lot of public relations firms. And all of these are detailed in this book, as well as the funding. So, Grant, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you on.
Hey, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me on again.
No problem. Enjoyed seeing you in Washington last March as well. And thank you for annually sponsoring these events. They're growing every year.
Yeah, they really are. And I think they're unique because sometimes you can have some speakers at other organizations that touch on this, but none of them give it the treatment it warrants. So it's really good that the crowds are growing, that people like you are, you know, talking about it and, you know, helping spread the word.
Well, they get bigger every year. And you see, even in the last one, we had a lot of speakers, but there are a lot of people in the audience who could have been speakers who came with Ralph Nader, Max Blumenthal, and so on. So you see,
absolutely.
Hopefully we'll get one on the West Coast here soon too. So.
Yeah, it would be great if there was one in the Midwest, the West Coast, you know, further northeast. I mean, it would be wonderful. Unfortunately, there is sort of a center of gravity in Washington that makes it easiest to do it here, but that's no excuse.
Well, we'll see. It'll expand. I want to talk to you about your book, but there's something that I saw that I got to talk to you about. And we did this before. I think one time I was interviewing you about how Israel acquired its nuclear weapons illegally. And right. It was the same day that Philip Nozette got busted on film taking bribes. And this is not as big news as that, but Dennis Ross was on C-SPAN and somebody called him to ask him some questions. I'm going to play the clip here in a second.
Great.
Get your thoughts on it.
Okay, let's listen.
Hey, Dennis, I want to know why there's such strict enforcement of the Jerusalem Embassy Act, which presidents have to sign a waiver not to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. And there's no enforcement of the Symington and Glenn Amendments to the Foreign Aid Act of 1961, which absolutely prohibit any U.S. foreign aid to clandestine foreign nuclear weapon states like Israel. It's because there are so many people who are essentially Israel lobbyists like yourself in government.
Well, I think that, you know, ultimately, different presidents have made the decision that when there are certain kinds of acts that they think will affect us from a security standpoint, they choose, if there's a national security waiver, they choose not to act on it. There has been, the Congress has passed laws that have passed resolutions that have suggested that our embassy should be in Jerusalem, and every president, Republican and Democratic alike, has decided at this point.
All right. I don't think he really answered the caller's question there. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thoughts are that he did not answer the second part of the question. And it really is an important question because the Symington Amendment to Arms Export Control Law is still there. And Stuart Symington, if you read all of the sort of legislative intent material about it at the National Archives, he's very clear about saying that the reason you need to have a ban on foreign aid to clandestine or non-nuclear, non-proliferation treaty countries is to avoid subsidizing their nuclear weapons program by essentially offsetting those conventional weapons expenses. And he was very explicit about that. Dennis Ross certainly knows about it. The Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department certainly knows about it. But you can never get any official in the executive branch while in office to admit that they're basically, they've been violating this law since 1976.
Really, Dennis Ross himself, I would consider an agent since he works for the Jewish People and Planning Institute, which was founded by the Jewish Agency.
Right.
The Jewish Agency, as exposed in your book. This is something I didn't know, and I know a lot about this stuff. They were actually outed as an outfit that has been subsidized by the Israeli government. And I'd like you to talk on that a bit about the Jewish Agency, because they were sort of the government in waiting, were they not?
Right. They were basically, you know, they come to prominence in the 1940s. They were cutting checks to purchase, illegally, by the way, surplus World War II arms. And, you know, they had a law firm, a point man in New York. They had operatives all over, but especially on the West Coast and East Coast, buying up munitions, buying up military aircraft engines, forming front companies to fly transport planes that could be, you know, transferred to Panama and then flown into Palestine. So it's really interesting. The FBI was on to them from the start. We've got some beautiful photographs of some B-17s that they sort of reflagged, if you want to call it that, and shipped overseas. So, and there were some very, very low-level prosecutions, but overall, this organization is now receiving American tax dollars every single year for so-called refugee resettlement. And it's been basically a driver of a great deal of organizational formation. They were basically paying Isaiah Kenan, the founder of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, paying him for his operations at the UN to gain recognition of the state. They were behind funding him as he put together AIPAC as an unincorporated lobbying division inside the American Zionist Council, which was shut down by a Justice Department foreign agents registration order. So they've been very, very active and involved behind the scenes. Michael Chertoff had relatives that were very active in the agency. They're amorphous in the fact that they have all of these associate agencies and executive boards. Very, very difficult to ever put together an organization chart about all of their operations and bodies. Senator J. William Fulbright tried one time, and it's well documented in the Senate record, but it's this amorphous blob that has, you know, it's got a lot of influence and clout, and it's again it's getting allocations of tax dollars now, and nobody knows about its history of, you know, arms dealing. It doesn't know, nobody knows about the connection with AIPAC, etc.
Well, how tight it was to government. It could, because the agency's executive committee chairman was David Ben-Gurion, who ended up becoming the prime minister of Israel.
Right. And they've got within their own covenants, which they tried to keep secret from investigators trying to understand how it functioned. They have legislative review powers still in the Knesset. So it's this very, you know, it's this organization that whenever they're sort of caught out, they rejigger their executive and chartering documents and pretend that they weren't actually in violation of any laws. It's just very, it's an organization that deserves to be known by anybody who's interested in how the lobby works, but it's relatively difficult to get information about.
Well, I was rereading some FBI field office reports in lieu of the 28 pages finally being released by the government about Saudi involvement in financing 9/11 hijackers, and this is something I made a film about, but after reading your book and connecting the agency to the government more than I had known before, there's a man named Ertain Wertheimer, who's an Israeli billionaire, who is the Jewish agency's board of governors member. And through intermediaries like Steve Witkoff, who's this mafia guy, he actually bribed the police commissioner of New York with $250,000. And Bernard Carrick, who was the commissioner, he ended up going to jail for that and taking bribes from the Gambino family, of all things. But what was interesting is in these FBI documents, in an unredacted footnote, the leader of one of these cells of people who were caught celebrating the attacks, and they were from Israel, and they didn't know much about them. But Paul Kersberg, who was the head of the cell, admitted to the New York agency there that he was sent there by the Jewish agency. It was interesting. And these were 9/11 suspects. And I had not put together how tight the agency was with the actual government of Israel, just Wertheimer and his billions and bribing the police. It was very
interesting. I'd love to see those documents. I haven't seen those before.
I've got them all published. I'll send them to you right after this interview. It's about 1,800 pages, but
thanks.
But you really only need three of them because there's redundancy. Like the other three reports are just New Jersey saying the same stuff, Miami saying the same stuff.
I think that case. I mean, you know, for anyone who's looked at the dancing Israeli FBI file. They should just be amazed that the general population, if you surveyed them, they would say, what happened on 9/11? Well, they would probably say Muslims are celebrating in New Jersey when, you know, the opposite is true. And it's one of those things where if you were to do a poll like the polls that we've done on, you know, who occupies who, Israelis occupy Palestinians or the reverse. You know, most Americans would, because of all the disinformation they've gotten, they just assume the opposite because that's what they've been told, either, you know, directly or indirectly. So,
well, between Eric and Giuliani, they'd gotten over $1 million from these conduits, and they're the ones that went on TV. Dan Rather is also, but they kept saying Middle Easterners were caught dancing. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't explain that they were Israelis, and they wouldn't explain that two of them, Paul Kersberg and Sivan Kersberg, the brother who was the driver of the van, were already flagged on the counterintelligence database as Mossad agents. Now, that makes it pretty safe to assume the other three were, because it's not like, you know, only two of them were mixed in with non-Mossad at the same time and working for Dominic Suter. But that's all in the documents. They all failed their polygraph tests multiple times, except for Omar Mamari. He basically cried and broke down and started telling the truth. But it's amazing to me that these FBI documents on the Saudis and Israelis aren't front line. But then again, when you start talking about 9/11, there's such an ether of stupid out there that you just get the word in.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the documents themselves raise more questions than the answer, as is usually the case. And, of course, anything truly interesting will not be released ever. Just under the FOIA guidelines, you know, they'll say this is a national security issue and the files will just never be released no matter what they say. So
well, I got the FOIA for these documents, and the problem is they gave me the documents, but they're heavily redacted. But
right.
What I was able to do is take the police reports and some of the reports from like the Jewish Daily Forward and Army Radio, etc., which already gave me the names of all the individuals. And basically just look at what they whited out and count letters, and I could Rosetta Stone the whole thing and figure out a lot more. But yeah, that took about a year of my life. But
yeah, well, you're well spent, it sounds like.
Well, it's good. I tried to get these. They took 76 photographs of the towers, including the first tower burning, which witnesses placed them there at 8 o'clock, 8:15, mm-hmm. the second witness. So they were there well before the first plane hit. But when I asked the Justice Department for those photocopies of the pictures, they sent me a letter back saying that they had been destroyed.
Okay. Well, I would like to see all of that, because I've not run across anything in what I've received that indicated that they were there before the planes hit. So I'd love to see that.
I'll give that all to you. I'm excited for you to see that. I want to get back into your book some more too. I mean, this is just a little tidbits of what you get from the Jewish agency. I mean, the Jewish agency is involved in everything, just like AIPAC, but you got to kind of start categorizing these things to get your head around it. And in the book, you have four categories for IAOs, Israeli affinity organizations.
Right.
What are these, and why is it so difficult to tally up the numbers for these groups?
Right. Well, the, you know, I started off again, trying to ask the question of how big is the lobby, you know, what functions do various parts of it serve? How has it evolved over time? What impact has it had? And I originally had about 12 categories, narrowed it down to 7. Even that was a little bit unmanageable. And so I finally just categorized the building blocks of the lobby, which you correctly called the Israel Affinity Organizations. Which is the term I use, into four categories, with the subsidy organizations, really $2 billion in 2012. These are the organizations that raise money and send it to a counterpart in Israel. So it could be a university like Bar Ilan. It could be the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. It could be the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, which is the largest and really the most important and virtually only significant Christian evangelical Israel affinity organization. To the Feinberg and the Weizmann Institute of Science, which has been involved in nuclear weapons development and research. And so the subsidy segment is simply those organizations that are, they exist to raise money and send it to Israel. They're largely self-regulated. They're becoming more intransparent as time goes on. The second, which I really think is important, is the fundraising and local political action segment. And I think it's important because it's not only, you know, 150 regional organizations, the so-called federations, which are so important to raising money and sending it on to other organizations and spending it themselves, but they're also, they each house a Jewish Community Relations Council, which is like a little APAC. It's the exact same model that APAC had when it was part of the American Zionist Council, an unincorporated, not separately reporting lobbying division that does a ton of lobbying at the local level. So when you see all of these simultaneous anti-Iran pieces of legislation being passed, it's because of these organizations working to do that and not reporting their lobbying for the most part. You know, a lot of people know about the legislative exchange councils, but they don't know anything about this. And this is every bit as important when it comes to Israel lobbying. And then finally, advocacy, you know, those organizations that are beating the drum for Israel and either lobbying like AIPAC or, you know, fighting any sort of accountability measures like the Anti-Defamation League. And then finally, the so-called education organizations, which are more, you know, more appropriately, they'd be called propaganda organizations, which are doing both internal and external education and indoctrination, like Birthright Israel, trying to shape the next generations of, you know, 100% Israel, unconditional supporters of Israel within the Jewish community, to Hillels on campus trying to control what's going on. You know, not so much worried about access anymore, but more worried about the fact that students are organizing and examining what's going on in the Israel-Palestine front.
I would Jewish call them propaganda and intimidation organizations because they smear them too.
You could definitely use other language for each of these segments, and I, you know, it's all about how you want to do it. Jewish Telegraphic Agency, which has a very interesting history that nobody knows about, in terms of offering to spy for the FBI in Latin America, offering to monitor Ukrainian groups inside the U.S. So, very interesting organizations. You know, the categories aren't perfect. There could probably be more. And just as a warning, you know, we're not talking about all of the activities that are going on. We're talking about one little sub-segment, which is sort of the nonprofit, charitable, tax-exempt arm. We're not talking about, you know, all of the media organizations, all of the outlets like Commentary and others that are essentially, you know, they were made to do this sort of lobbying. We're not talking about the think tanks for the most part. We're not talking about captured government or entities. We're not talking about synagogues and churches that send a lot of money on their own. We're only talking about, for the most part, 501c3s, many, you know, sort of the midpoint birthday of most of these organizations was 1975. Most of them have evolved away substantially from their original tax-exempt purpose that they told the IRS or the IRS's predecessor about why they should be considered to be charities. So it's a real interesting evolution you can observe just by sort of putting them into these ballywicks and looking at what they've done over time.
And to point out to people who may not know how these things work, that these charities get tax exemption, and also the charities are able to then pass that money along to other agencies like the JA, who, mm-hmm. who are actually part of the state of Israel. So we're actually subsidizing their government through quote-unquote charities like the United Israel Appeal, which I think you mentioned earlier, the United Israel Appeal. Well, I don't know if you named them, but in your book you did, how they are getting money from the State Department's Migration and Refugee Assistance account to resettle Jews who are not actually refugees into Israel, and then they turn around and give money to the Jewish Agency, which is part of the State of Israel, quasi.
Yeah, they do, exactly. The federations, I mean, originally they were supposed to do a substantial amount of transfers to the Jewish Agency, and that has been problematic. You know, there have been some studies at places, various university type studies, mostly focused on, oh, how does the rise of these American Friends of Organizations affect the Jewish Agency? They used to get a lot more money, but now they really haven't. But it's important to know that the Jewish Agency in 1973, sort of right after the last time the Justice Department really tried to regulate their activities in the U.S., Congress allotted them $25 million a year for refugee resettlement. And this has totaled $460 million through 1991. The Congressional Research Service then reported between 2000 and 2013, they received another $534 million in tax dollars from Congress. And, you know, you're essentially right. This is basically going to complete the Israeli government's program of trying to increase their population. And, you know, in terms of the overlap between the Jewish Agency and Israeli government, you know, it's substantial overlap there.
Aliyah is not refugees. I mean, they're just immigrants. I mean, they're really right. Stretching the word refugee there. I mean, they're just offering people a free ride to come live in Israel, especially if they'll become a settler.
Well, they would argue that, you know, like with Ukraine and the instability there, they suddenly... mainly through evangelical Christian organizations as the vehicle, suddenly started transferring a bunch of people. They did it with Iran, and they would say, oh, these were people who were in danger, although the Iranian Jewish community quickly said, no, they weren't in danger. They have, you know, this was all a PR campaign, but that's what they call them. But I would say you're right. In a lot of cases, it has a lot more to do with PR and trying to raise Israel's profile than it does actual refugee resettlements. I mean, you know, the real refugees are obviously those who have been displaced in Iraq and Syria and that sort of thing. Those are obviously more numerous and more in desperate need.
There might be some refugees from Ukraine, but I know in the past that there have been incidents that were manufactured in order to say, okay, now, like in Iran, where somebody would go shoot a theater or a synagogue or something. And then, you know, now we want to import all the Jews from this area. And they got busted in Egypt with Operation Susanna or the Levant Affair, bombing Western targets. And this is something that went on. And it just doesn't matter when they get caught. It's like, oh, well, because the British and French still jumped on Israel's side in the 56 war anyway. But you see that all the time. And when you brought up the Weizmann Institute,
right?
That's not really a charitable organization or solely for science. I mean, how can you say it's to the benefit of, or for social welfare to enrich uranium with lasers or something like that?
Right, right. Well, that's, you know, the FBI was onto that relatively early. They had a good handle when they were tracking some espionage that was going on by Israeli students in U.S. university systems trying to crack into government military databases, they developed information very quickly on that the Weizmann Institute for Science was an Israeli nuclear weapons front. The Department of Energy, you know, they know all of these things, but this is some of the information they try hardest not to release under FOIA, because it then calls into question all sorts of compliance issues with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, these arms export controls, and the fact that they just never really prosecute any of it. They treat it like, you know, the pesky neighbor who stole your hedge trimmer out of your garage. That's, you know, it's never, never
it's just
treated.
Uranium.
Yeah, right. It's never treated with any real gravity. And, you know, will the FBI, now that Zalman Shapiro finally died, will they release the photos of him meeting with Israeli intelligence officials at Pittsburgh International Airport? I mean, probably not. But those pictures, if they were circulated widely instead of obituaries talking about how wonderful he was in working on the Nautilus submarine program. This is the founder of NUMEC, by the way, who diverted the organization that diverted weapons grade uranium to Israel. Would the pictures finally tell a story? Would anyone pick that up? And the answer is, even if they released them, the answer is probably no.
Yeah, I gotta say no, because they just released 28 redacted pages from the Senate investigation report detailing almost exclusively their sources were FBI field offices. And I'm sitting there thinking, what about Pakistan? What about Israel? Because I've read those same reports, so I know what they did not say, but I know it's there, and they just ignored it. Was Glenn T. Seaborg part of the Wiseman Institute?
He went after he left the Atomic Energy Commission. He was fated by the Wiseman Institute in a big ballroom, and he wrote a speech about how Israel was, you know, pursuing Adams for peace and all that. But he was never actually part of the Wiseman Institute. Some of the investigators that Kennedy sent to Dimona to see if they were involved in nuclear research were part of the Wiseman Institute. And so that was a sham. There's a new, semi-new book by an author named Stillman called Nuclear Express, which really explains much more about the Wiseman Institute's role in nuclear weapons development. You know, we tried to do a little bit, explained in the book, a little bit of probing at the IRS about whether anybody could explicitly fund laser enrichment and the mounting of a nuclear device on a missile in Israel as an explicitly charitable program. And they wouldn't issue any sort of opinion on that in writing, although I did get a phone call from an IRS agent who said he thought that probably wouldn't cut it. So
ask them just to switch Israel with North Korea and then see what they say.
Like, right.
Would we do that for that country? I think in the book you mentioned Isidore Rabi. He was sent to Dimona, and he was on the Board of Governors.
That was it. Yeah.
But I wasn't sure about Glenn T. Seaborg. I knew he was on the Atomic Energy Commission. Robert Kennedy saw around that anyway. And we learned about that in some of the talks in D.C., or I did. I guess you already knew. But
well, right. The Kennedys did not want the Israelis to go nuclear. They were – it's pretty obvious they were aware of what was going on. Seaborg was basically just a big obstacle. And it's still, you know, when Department of Energy officials confronted him and they said, one of your contractors, Mr. Seaborg, was, you know, some of the very unique signature uranium that they were handling that you supplied them with for processing has been picked up in Israel. He noted that down in his office diary, but after that, he refused to talk to the FBI and he refused to ever alter his opinion that, oh, maybe this was just a sample or something like that. So he was basically a big obstacle to all this. But I've read through volumes of information about him. I don't think he was any sort of collaborator in diversion. It doesn't strike me that he was.
Just covering up his incompetence or something, or just didn't want.
Well, he had a mutually contradictory role of promoting nuclear industries and regulating them. It was an impossible task, and he tended to default, since he was such a prominent figure, you know, the inventor of plutonium, tended to default on the side of promoting nuclear industries rather than properly regulating them, especially the safeguards part.
Yeah, well, Apollo, Pennsylvania is now polluted with the...
Right. And this is such a, I mean, we've talked about NUMEC before, But the fact that American taxpayers are going to be on the hook for $500 million in cleanup, the Justice Department, I just found this out in court, you know, one of the reasons they won't respond to FOIA requests for their final conclusion report in the late 1970s about the diversion is that they are still secretly negotiating, trying to make a successor company pay for all the cleanup as if they were the ones who set up a shoddy smuggling front and polluted the entire two company sites. And so the Justice Department, they have such a questionable role in many of these things in terms of covering up, and they're trying to pressure this company to do something and they're fighting you in court. I mean, I wrote an article called, you know, the Justice Department wears many hats in the new Mech affair. And they just they really do. They have, just like Seaborg, mutually contradictory, mutually exclusive roles. And they really, they're just, they shouldn't be doing any of what they're doing right now.
I agree. And the part of the charitable organizations, I'm trying to tackle all these categories. You've got some that collect money exclusively outside the U.S. and some that only get domestically collecting inside. And yet they can trade with each other. So is that just another way around the FARA laws?
Well, for example, the Jewish Agency pumped in a bunch of money from overseas. And this is actually in the Senate investigation in 1963, because there just wasn't still, even though there was a significant takeover by Zionist organizations of Jewish social welfare organization and fundraising. They were pumping money in to get sort of kickstarted this whole Israel lobbying initiative that would then transfer a significant portion of the responsibility for paying for Israel to American taxpayers. But they would argue that Karen Hesod, you know, the United Israel Appeal international component is completely separate from the United Israel Appeal, which is its U.S. counterpart, and that you know, even though they're raising money and the others raising money, that the funds aren't commingled and blah blah blah. None of it verifiable. None of it actually. You know, there's still really no paper trail or audit trail for knowing. And many people still suspect that, like in the 1960s, international dollars still come into the U.S. when no domestic partner can be found for lobbying or PR initiative. The Jewish Agency still spends money in the U.S., which is, you know, it's questionable because here we are paying them tax dollars. And then some of that obviously is coming back into the U.S. still, although they do file foreign agent Registration Act reports. So, but the fungibility, you know, in terms of the total picture, you know, let's just look at it. How big is the Israel lobby and all of these affinity groups? In 2012, about $3.7 billion raised in the U.S. Looks like it's on track to reach about $6.3 billion in 2020. We're talking about 14,000 employees accounted for by these 336 organizations studied. They claim about 350,000 volunteers. If you look at the upper number of how many people they could actually claim to be members, using Pew data, not their data, it's probably about the size of Charlotte, North Carolina, 774,000 members, which is not the entire Jewish population of America, which they would claim they represent, but rather just a tiny fraction, about 18%. So there's a lot of money, a lot of donors who give, you know, upwards of 20% of each organization's budgets. Sheldon Adelson pops up time after time as being the primary funder of multiple organizations. But, you know, any claims on representing or having membership of, you know, the entire American Jewish population, absolutely not. The Christian evangelicals do not supply what a lobby needs most, which is money. They supply some bodies and ideological, you know, support when they vote, but they are completely irrelevant when it comes to the money. You know, organizations like Christians United for Israel, before they went dark, raising about $12 million, which is nothing in this ecosystem. Christians and Jews United, you know, about 112 million, but they received support for setting up their fundraising infrastructure, their PR and all this from big seed donors to the Israel lobby. So, you know, I think if anything,
individuals too, like Sheldon Anderson, you mentioned, or Haim Sabant backing Hillary Clinton. He's a big Zionist too.
Absolutely.
Hillary's doing the same thing using Frank Gustra's outfit in Canada to wash dirty money. She's getting money from foreign governments and foreign states that goes to the charity in Canada, which then donates to the Clinton Foundation, which goes in her pocket because they're not doing a fraction of the charitable work that they claim. It's just
the way. Right. It's very interesting. And you know, what you also see, and I've heard of, I've read exactly the same thing that you said. You also see a lot of these movers and shakers in the Jewish Community Relations Councils, the mini APACs regionally, suddenly a significant number of them will suddenly be on a campaign committee or organizing the fundraising for one candidate. And you're supposed to believe that this is separate from their organizational activity. And it's really not. It's all about, we support this candidate because this candidate's going to do the most for, you know, for Israel. So it's a very the FEC is unable to enforce any campaign finance laws because of its makeup. And that's been proven in a case against APAC for basically directing independent PACs or so-called independent PACs. But yeah, there's a lot of overlap with the political campaigns, no doubt about it.
I think there's also some irony there that they put the word Jewish, Jewish community, Jewish federation, Jewish whatever in their titles, but they're just Israeli lobbies. They're Zionist Likudnik Israeli lobbies. And actually, usually the antithesis of what actual Jewish communities in the United States ideologically partake in and follow.
Right. If you look through the lists and you can go to israellobby.org and see the segmentation and all of these organizations, that is true. It's a way to appropriate, and you know, nobody wants to criticize an organization that has such a religious connotation to it. It's definitely interesting. Some of them, though, are, you know, New Israel Fund, the American Friends of Megan David Adom, Jerusalem Foundation, Central Fund of Israel. I mean, a lot of them mention Israel as well. Others completely incomprehensible. It's really hard to tell from the name of the organization what they do.
Karen Hesod. I mean, what is that, right?
Right. Yeah, that's the United Israel Appeal. And that's when Benjamin Netanyahu talks about United Israel Appeal, he uses that name. So and they're very interesting in terms of, again, being sort of a mirror image. But the U.S. is clearly, I mean, I have not done a comparative analysis of all the organizations. People keep encouraging more comparison with the European BICOM and all of that. I don't have comparative data, but I tend to think that the U.S. fundraising operation is certainly the most important and has been for a long time for Israel.
I forget the org, but wasn't there a case where like $144,000 went to some untraceable business in D.C.?
Right.
It's just a residential dweller. That reminded me of 9/11 too, because you had the Denko Mechanical affair where they were illegally hiring people to work on fire prevention systems, and turned out they didn't even have the correct licenses and faked reference letters and everything else. They got arrested too. But $144,000 is a lot.
Well, right. And there are a number of organizations that are run out of homes, you know, and they even report, I would say somewhat blatantly, that they're buying vehicles, you know, with their so-called charitable donations. You know, very, very hard to understand the legitimacy of a lot of these organizations. You see things like that, the undescribed payment. I don't think I connected any of that to any sort of 9/11 type thing.
It wasn't. It was just the same style, and the fact that I went to an obsolete residential address. People got arrested on, serendipitously, they got arrested getting fake IDs in Tennessee, which you don't need a social security number for, or you didn't in 2001. And then on the person of one of the individuals arrested, he had these a pass to the World Trade Center to do work from September 5th. And so they said, work for who? And it just traced back to all that stuff I said. It was a fake company, so it was suspicious. The key witness in that case was burned to death the day before the trial. Her name was Catherine Smith.
Oh, boy.
Burned in her car, which she borrowed from Khalil Abdallah, which is a man from Jerusalem, who was a ringleader of the whole thing. Never spent a day in jail. It's really nasty. It was in all the Memphis papers and things, and it's just the thing, little things like this, which I don't think are that little, just get lost because there's just so much, conspiracy, baloney and stuff about these kind of things. And so it's hard to get the hard evidence out. And in even talking about the Israeli lobby, you'll have people that will just dismiss it either with, oh, you're anti-Semitic, which is lame, or, oh, that's just, you know, so you're talking about like the Jews around the world or some crazy stuff like that. We're like, no, we're just look.
Yeah,
Israel's a country and they do nasty things like lots of countries.
Right. I think that is an interesting charge. The fact that you have so many press accounts calling an organization like the American Jewish Committee sort of the State Department of the American Jewish community. And I would say, well, if you've only got 18% membership in these organizations, that's a pretty brash claim to be making. And to have the Washington Post and New York Times repeating it is even worse. And in terms of studying the lobby, I think getting back to locations, you have at 633 Third Avenue in New York City, an Israeli bank, you've got the Jewish agency, you've got the various Israel affinity organizations, all at one single address, kind of doing business, this huge agglomeration, and being able to interface between foreign and domestic organizations. Just a very interesting complex over there on Third Avenue in New York City. The World Zionist Organization is there. The Bank of Israel is there. The Council of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations is there. This Conference of Presidents is co-located with the World Zionist Organization. Same office. So, whether there's any difference between this designated foreign agent and this coordinating committee for all of the top advocacy organizations, I just find it hard to argue that there's any real meaningful separation. And yet, again, the Justice Department, uninterested in any of this. They used to be very interested. They've lost interest because, they can order these organizations to register like they did the Zionist Organization of America 7 times. But political pressure and lobbying always trumps the law when it comes to any real effort to regulate.
Well, that's because they have such terrific PR, and that's why we've got to win the PR war, which is why I'm screening a film in LA about Palestine next month and at least start chipping away at it. But bigger than that, we've got the BDS movement breaking out through colleges and also churches for the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement. Talk about BDS. Are they having a real positive effect yet, or is it just wishful thinking?
Well, it's causing a conundrum because boycott has been one of the lauded tools of various Israel lobby organizations. They want a boycott of Iran. They wanted boycotts of, the Soviet Union. They wanted boycotts of this and that. And so to turn on the tactic and say that the tactic is unwarranted, if you're targeting, this brutal treatment and basically open air prison in Gaza, that is an inappropriate use of boycott. It's not working for them. The Anti-Defamation League is having a very difficult time. They've alternately said that no, boycott is a respected American tradition of protest, and then come out under pressure of donors to say, no, actually it's bad. But they haven't won any major court battles
in the U.S.
And they're not Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard to say how on free speech grounds they're going to be able to do that. But as I note in the book, and I have to say this, Jewish federations pump money into the American Civil Liberties, the ACLU. They pump money into the Electronic Freedom Frontier. And I've noticed that in certain key battles, those organizations are notably absent. So they have had some wins in terms of just not allowing sort of the premier self-designated civil rights and civil liberties organizations off the field. So that's difficult. But, you know, to the extent that they can continue to pump money into the regents of these various universities, that's having a major impact. When you look at federation check cutting, and there's a whole chapter of that in the book, you know, they don't give money to a college or university. They don't give it to the sports or the cultural sections. They give it directly to the regents. So the regents getting a $60,000 check are going to understand that some of that funding cut to their little enclave inside of a university is not going to happen if they allow BDS to get out of hand. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes that you can see through the funding flows, including sort of the, you know, the mobilization of Hillels to counter BDS. Some of them are open, but most of them are stridently against it. They're mobilizing. So there's no, I think it's a little early to say whether it's successful or not, but it certainly got their attention.
Well, it's certainly grown since 2002 when I started a divestment movement in my college. It wasn't even called BDS back then. It was only like three colleges doing it, but it's certainly grown. That's because of the PSM help organize it. And then of course, basically things like Facebook and MySpace and social media were invented, and so it became a lot easier to network with each other. I wanted to ahead.
I was just going to say that whenever you hear a current or recently emerged student leader, and we've had several of them at our conference, talk about what they're actually doing, it is so non-threatening and so professionally done in many cases that then you look at what the other side has done in terms of, you know, putting up these grotesque posters of people being dragged through the street and beaten up, trying to really frame these organizations as somehow being violent or trying to do something illegal. It's just, it's incredible. But, it's equally incredible to hear some of these activists and all of the trauma they had to go through while simultaneously trying to get a degree from, you know, George Mason or some other university. And you just never see these kids on any sort of, you know, broadly distributed outlet. And it's a shame because they really are eloquent and they really are concerned. It's not like you can tell the difference between someone who's just getting paid to mouth various pablums about
talking points and things.
Yeah, talking points, because it's all produced by, a lot of it's produced by PR firms and Frank Luntz, you know, how to talk and how to get away from the real issue type talking points. But it just doesn't stand up to somebody who's really really articulate in his study. We had Tarek Roddy, who was he's at Georgetown now, but he organized a whole boycott at George Mason University. You know, just an incredible speaker. And people should really check out his presentation at israelsinfluence.org. The video and the transcript are there.
I remember how it backfired when they told the students they couldn't have a room. So they started holding meetings outside, which just meant all the students passing by would see them and see they're peacefully sitting there and talking, and it just made more people join.
Well, it's like a microcosm of America's bigger problem with blowback. You do something and it, the opposite results. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes I think they're intended consequences, but I'm kind of
cynical. cynicism is warranted when you've seen how many decades this stuff has been going on. So.
Yeah, I did a film called Decades of Deception on that. So the book you mentioned earlier was Nuclear Express. Is that correct?
Right. You can tell which are the good books because they typically are not selling very well.
Well, I have a tight circle of nerds that buy these things, so Nuclear okay. Express. Frank Luntz, by the way, is a focus of the film Occupation of the American Mind.
Right.
And Sut Jolly, the executive producer, is going to come and do a Q&A August 21st in Los Angeles, if anybody.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, and it really is talking points. It really is. Don't say it like this. Say it like that.
Right.
I mean, purely just they don't care about morality or truth or anything. It's just here's how to manipulate people. But, of course, Israel's a country that has a show, unlike Donald Trump's Apprentice, where they're trying to get a job. It's called The Ambassador, where it's focused on who can lie the best.
Right.
It's a show about it. The best liar.
Right. Right. And there's always, again, try to segue into children and talking about the future of children whenever, you know, concrete points come up. And it's just so manipulative. And so, you know, you can almost see it happening in real time whenever you tune into any sort of network news. In the rare circumstances this even comes up, you can almost say, okay, he's going to segue to children. Okay, he's going to talk about the future. Okay, he's going to do this.
Do the turntable thing where they put an assertion in the question like, what would you do if 3,000 rockets were fired at you every day? Which makes you assume that it's true that 3,000 rockets are being fired every day. Or actually, they'd probably say missiles, which it isn't. But it's like, well, that's a stupid hypothetical because that's not the situation. So don't ask me that.
Right.
Because Hamas and the terrorist organization, I always say, is the CIA a terrorist organization? Because I can make a pretty good case for that.
Yeah, I don't think it's backfiring, though. I mean, you know, even though these Frank Luntz global language guides or whatever they're called have constantly leaked, it doesn't have any impact. You still see people pretty much going through the various points in real time. And so there's no embarrassing any of the organizations or activists who use them.
You can tell when they get a new one issued because it's uniform across the three-letter networks where they all start saying the same catchphrase. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right.
It's so
the Global Language Dictionary, right. Yeah. Well, one of the real questions I have is the Israel Project, which chartered Frank Luntz to do this sort of, here's how to talk. The IRS cannot find, or at least it claims it cannot find, the organization's application for tax exempt status, because basically the organization is nothing more than a PR firm for the Israeli government. And yet, you know, is it possible to read the justification for why they receive tax exempt status? And the answer is no. And I've never had that happen before, except in the case of the applications that have been destroyed because of, you know, sort of standard government document destruction laws, although I question why you would ever do that. But very interesting that the organization that chartered this whole very Orwellian, you know, Israel speak guide can't know why they're considered, as opposed to, you know, a foreign agent for the Israeli government doing PR in the U.S., why they're considered to be a charity of all things.
Well, they blame the document destruction on NARA, the National Archives and Record Administration. They just say, untitle this, code this, blah, 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 and they were destroyed. That's what I get.
No,
I'm like,
no, and
but why?
Yeah.
This one, they can't find them, right?
Right. It's mainly pre-1948 organizations that have been destroyed by NARA. But this one, this is a relatively new organization, so it's questionable. They came up with AIPAC's application as a religious organization 6 weeks after, you know, their parent was ordered to register. They managed to cough that up. But one of the things that's in the book, which since we're talking about the IRS, is the IRS commissioners who did some really, you know, yeoman service for the lobby by quashing this or promoting that. And it's, you know, Mortimer Kaplan is probably the most egregious. After he was ordered to investigate the basis upon which all these organizations that were investigated in the 60s, how they ever received tax exempt status, Even before the investigation was done, he recertified the fact that they were charities, and then he refused to investigate any of them under order by the Senate. So just a really scandalous treatment of a Senate inquiry, and then he's basically replaced by someone even worse. So there's a listing of IRS commissioners and whether they were upholding their mandate or not, and those two certainly weren't.
Well, we're running up on the hour, so we're going to run out of time. I was going to ask you maybe real quickly about the Jewish Telegraph Agency cozying up to the FBI. You alluded to that story in the beginning. What were they doing?
Essentially, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, like the ADL, was very interested in having kind of an insider relationship with the FBI. And so they wrote down a proposal offering to spy in Latin America for the FBI in the 40s, when the FBI was trying to build more of a presence and better understand, probably in this case, the threats of Nazi Germany and the infiltration of Axis powers and all of that. And so I was very surprised to get this. It would have been the type of document that would have been normally transferred to the National Archives. There it is, a written proposal to J. Edgar Hoover saying, hey, we'd really love to be contract spies for you. We can leverage this network we have in Latin America. Other agencies are using us. We can also spy on Ukrainians in the U.S., and this is supposedly a news gathering organization, but you know it was presided over by one of the top arms smugglers, Rudolf Sonnenborn, who basically formed a network in the U.S. in the 40s for smuggling arms. Very questionable activities, you know. Basically, a propaganda.
Do you have this up on IRMAP?
It's at the Israel Lobby Archive. If you go to IsraelLobby.org. And you would need to page to, and in the little icons on that page, there's one for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. And
I have a hunch from what you just said, thinking so pre CIA, you basically have the Federal Bureau of Narcotics trying to brand new, you know, trying to follow around this narco traffic that organized crime is bringing into the US, which is, very much tied to the post-Italian and the newly created Israeli state in the 40s. But at that same time that the FBN was trying to stop these drugs, the State Department was secretly assisting it, especially in Honduras and places like that. And so I'm wondering who exactly they're spying on in some of these characters, because some of what you were just naming, it hit some red flags, and I can't confirm it yet, but I really want to go over these documents. I'm excited about that now.
Yeah. Well, they're very interesting. It's one of the ones that says new, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, you know, came out of research for this book. And you know, they're still around. Anytime they detect some issue, you know, whether it's prosecution of the APAC spies or whatever, you know, they're out there screaming and trying to whip up support, and that it's still doing this sort of behind the scenes stuff. Who knows? But I don't know. I know that there are overlaps with other news gathering organizations and, you know, the Mockingbird project of the CIA to get their messages out. But this is pretty blatant. Please hire us to be your spies in Latin America. We want to work with you, FBI type thing. And it wasn't.
Chapman,
it wasn't
work with him, and he was part of those Miami offices where they're bringing the coke in from Colombia. So it's nothing. I'm not saying this is true, but this is something I'm going to start looking into because it's got a lot of overlap.
All right. So well, check it out.
Yeah, I always find good stuff on from IRMAP too, and so. Yeah, thank you for your time today. And really, there's a lot more in the book. I wanted to do two interviews on it, but I know you're a busy guy.
Yeah, you're going to see some interesting stuff coming out really soon on the legal front. So you'll know where I've been spending all my time. But again, I thank you for the opportunity to come on. If people want to buy a book that kind of shows all of the recent thinking, it's Big Israel, and you can get it on Amazon.
You can get it on the link right below if you're watching this on YouTube or ANC. Just click that link and get it, Big Israel. Right. There's graphs in here. When we condense it down into an hour, it seems overwhelming. But if you have a book and you can sit down and read it and look back and go back and forth, it's not that confusing. It's as clear as it can get with a topic like this, I think. And I highly recommend it. I wouldn't be doing this otherwise. And hopefully I'll see you in D.C. again next year.
Absolutely. And, maybe we can talk about this when you have another slot open up. I do want to do another interview because there is so much to go through.
Well, I want to wait till your court things or your proceedings, whatever, when you're allowed to talk about this thing are done, because I want to get into that. But I wasn't sure what you can say and what you can't say yet.
All right. So. Well, yeah, can't say virtually anything. But if people want, bulletins and updates, you can sign up for the email list at earmep.org and get on the email list, and you'll be the first to know.
There you go. I just started my own e-zine too, so you can sign up for that. We'll link both of those below this talk. And thank you very much. You're always welcome on this show.
All right, Rye. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Yeah. Take it back to 47 before your inception, before the terror lives lost in the U.S. weapons, before the foreign aid, 10 mil a day, Holocaust always the excuse that they say. But look at Gaza, tell me no genocide, Hamas rockets do nothing, retaliation to children dying. Got no right to defense when you occupy the seas, the people, water, earth, and the sky. You target civilians, human shields a lie. Now you scream insults as Roger Waters on our side. UN resolutions yet, prohibit solution, puppet support, draw public conclusions. Now I'm seeing the world as Palestinian youths over rocks, firing at your troops. I'ma send my salute to all my fam, seeing the truth. Gonna break your siege like flotillas with food. We gotta end AIPAC and free Palestine. I said end AIPAC, free, free Palestine. Do it for the millions slowly dying. Do it for the souls martyred all the time. End AIPAC, free, free Palestine. End AIPAC, free, free Palestine. Like what they done before, what we saw in the apartheid state. Drop the war, abolish AIPAC, it's a global revolution. Long live into fodder, cause your lobby's pollution. Ruthless our movement, US Christian saluters with Christ endorsed. Lethal baby shooters, money can't buy a life. Back of buses for your wives, if you black too bad, our society's light. That's why we destroyed the land, planting pines, settlements and soldiers. So take a hike to a neighboring country, all have no rights. Different schools, roads, and oh that's right. You throw a rock at a tank, you an anti-Semite. 75% of Congress take your money, but somehow Americans have no worrying about your creed or what you believe. It's their racist greed, constant resource need combined with hate, destroying the Middle East. Yeah, end AIPAC and free Palestine. I said end AIPAC, free, free Palestine. Do it for the millions slowly dying. Do it for the souls martyred all the time. End AIPAC, free, free Palestine. End AIPAC, free, free Palestine. Like what they done before, what we saw in the apartheid state. Drop the war, push for war. Ran so politicians sang in support for blood, like bombing Iraq. This infectious disease, the worst we've had. 4 billion plus and nothing back, except dead Americans and millions from war bombs and hate. Knocking at your door, the media again. You implore to lie, blame Islam for it all. Disgusting fallacies at AIPAC rallies. That's why in Washington, here we carry Palestinian flags and rock kafirs. Palestine a horror, you will never defeat us. Here are marching feet, West Bank to Sydney, Dublin, London, Berlin, Washington streets. Better look up the facts so you understand me, then join, not listen when we scream. We gotta end AIPAC and free Palestine. I said end AIPAC, free, free Palestine. Do it for the millions slowly dying. Do it for the souls martyred all the time. End AIPAC, free, free Palestine. End AIPAC, free, free Palestine. Like what they done before, what we saw in the terror lobby. Drop the